Live on CKNW and across the Chorus Radio Network, this is Warren. Now, here is Peter Warren.
We head into hour two with a reminder that coming up in hour three, we'll have the weekend and we'll have a discussion about the relatively new federal registry for sex offenders. We're going down to Moncton, New Brunswick for that one. I want you to meet via the phone now Kenda G, who is an Edmonton chair of the Chinese-Canadian Head Tax and Exclusion Act Redress Committee, and Mei Chu, who is counsel for the Chinese-Canadian Head Tax and Exclusion Act Redress Committee. Mei is in Montreal. To put it in perspective for anybody across this country who doesn't know what I'm talking about, when we headed into the break at the top of the hour, I read one paragraph of an email from Danny Park, who is listening in Edmonton. I want to read one more paragraph, which kind of puts it in perspective. He said, "Warren, my dad came to Canada in the year of 1919. For his entry, he had to pay $500 head tax, which he borrowed from many relatives and friends. Dad told me the $500 in those days was equivalent to more than 3 years of salary. It took him many, many years to pay off this huge debt to his friends and relatives. Because of the Exclusion Act, Mom and I were not allowed to come to Canada, so I was being raised alone in China by my mom. During the Depression, Dad was still paying his friends off for the head tax that he had borrowed. Consequently, he had very little money saved to send to us in China. We almost starved to death. We resorted to eating whatever we could find, tree roots, tree barks, insects, and worms, etc. After the first 12 years of my life without him, Dad went back to China to see us in 1948. Mom was very ill then due to the many years of malnutrition. She never made it to Canada. She passed away in 1949. Kenda and Mei, thanks for joining us. In perspective, tell us where this whole thing is going and how far the negotiations have gone.
Hi, Peter. It's Kenda from Edmonton. If Mei doesn't mind me going a bit first here, I guess I'll just explain that. The campaign, as you probably know, came to a standstill in 1994 when Sheila Finestone made a sudden surprise announcement in the House of Commons that there was no longer any funds available to redress this issue.
Yeah.
There was originally an all-party resolution in 1984 which was to have dealt with this matter. After the legal suit that was launched by one of the groups in Toronto, not much has taken place in the way of further lawsuits, although that's still obviously another route. In terms of the actual lobby effort, something that Mei and I would like to tell your audience is that there has been a National Film Board documentary that was produced recently. It's received quite a bit of feedback and interest from the viewing audience, and it will be airing on CBC News World this upcoming Tuesday at 11 p.m. I believe it's going to be 7 p.m. your time, Peter, and also 10 p.m. on News World.
Mm-hmm. I think the short answer to your question is that there has been no negotiations.
That's what I was getting at, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so where do we stand? Obviously, you people have not given up. Are you getting any positive response from the Martin cabinet?
Well, one thing we want to talk about today, Peter, is that Paul Martin, the Prime Minister, had been asked a few weeks ago in Montreal about the issue, and his response seemingly was that he was still unclear what it was the Chinese community wanted. From our perspective, obviously, we've been unequivocal as to what we're looking for, and that is an acknowledgement, individual compensation, and possibly some form of collective redress. So it doesn't matter which of those reasons they could present. There's always some sort of rationale as to why negotiations have not proceeded further. However, our priority is that because there's probably no more than 100 or 200 actual survivors, that to actually acknowledge them in terms of economic reasons or rationale would be very, very small. Because you take, as an example, the recent redress campaigns with the Merchant Mariners or the World War II vets who are paid, let's say, on average $20,000 a person, if you took that amount and you applied it to 100 individuals who are still alive, your total bill would be $2 million. So our priority, and I think May would agree because our groups have worked together for a while now, that the priority at this stage should try to present that acknowledgement and the compensation to those who actually paid the penalties when they first came to Canada.
Respond, either of you, to this email that's just come in, if you will, from Amelia Antoschuk in Langley, British Columbia. Redress not in the form of money. Education of the past. Apology, yes, as there are so many ethnic groups who settled Canada and could fit the redress claim. The Chinese were never interned or put into camps, as were many other ethnic groups. Of alien Canadians who were in Canada in August 1914, of the 80,000, the First World War started in June of 14, there were 8,579 interned in labor camps. 5,954 were classified as Austro-Hungarian, most of them Ukrainian. They were interned in Spirit Lake, Vernon camps, five receiving stations in Montreal, Toronto, Niagara Falls, Sault Ste. Marie and Winnipeg, making the point, I'll cut the letter short, that they feel that they have claims as well.
Well, Peter, I'm going to let May answer this question as well, because I think both of us probably could give an answer that would take an entire day.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the short of it, at least from my perspective, is that this issue of volition or willingness is entirely bogus, as you may know from some of the letters that have been sent into the Georgia Strait in Vancouver. The fact of the matter is that when Chinese arrived to Canada, they were detained in an immigration cell or cage. Now, these individuals were interned up to 2 or 3 months at a time. From what we know of the evidence, the wall poetry that later became known,
yeah,
certainly doesn't show that this was done willingly. And their circumstance, their plight, something that people often overlook, is that when they fled China, China was considered a friendly or peaceful nation in peacetime. The reason why that the exploitation was allowed to take place was because they were a defeated nation. And because of the turmoil that was in part caused by the Opium Wars and British imperialism, forced them to leave their country. So I don't know how we can kind of say that, you know, there are other issues that we have to deal with and it's not as bad as this or that. The fact of the matter is, if you ask many of the people interested in redress, if you ask me, should Japanese Canadians be redressed? Of course they should. Should Ukrainian Canadian communities be redressed? Yes, they should. The question with the Chinese specifically, Peter, is why the Chinese? Well, in our case, this is an ancient history. We're talking about seniors who are still alive. They're our neighbors, our co-workers, our friends. Now, we think that they are owed that priority or that respect to negotiate while they're still alive. And although I can appreciate that we're talking about issues that go far back as the Acadians, this issue is definitely not ancient history.
May you get in here.
Yeah, I agree completely with Kenda. I think that in terms of principle, I agree that if the government has harmed an individual or a group of individuals, then these people should be compensated. It's a straight question of justice. I think that you can also respond by just rereading the email from Danny Park, was it, that you just read in the beginning.
Yep.
It shows very clearly how there was pain and suffering inflicted, not just on the individual family and the mother, the women, but also on the community in Montreal. One of our campaign symbols is James Wing, who is currently 93 years old, he is very open to share with us the stories of how he spent, I think, 2 or 3 weeks in the immigration detention center when he came over as a 12-year-old boy, and what life was like for him and his father growing up alone in Canada in the Bachelor Society. I have no qualms at all. I don't think it's right to make us or to describe this issue as different groups must compete against each other. If the
right.
government has harmed someone, then they should be compensated.
Has the government ever stood up and said, we're sorry?
Well, Peter, the closest I believe they've come is that in the House of Commons with Sheila Finestone, she said, we realize that these things had happened and they were unjust, and unfortunately we don't have any compensation available at the time. I'm obviously paraphrasing. But the short answer, Dane, is no, nothing really has been offered. You know, to get to this idea of weighing differences of injustices, I think this is kind of the trap that all groups fall into, is that you've got a divide and conquer approach from Ottawa, and so it's easy for them to skirt the issue by saying, well, if we redress this group, we're going to have to redress another. You know, the point is that if we have that means of doing it, we should do so. And keep in mind as well, Peter, I'm a Chinese Canadian myself. But I'm the first to say I've been unjustly enriched in the same way that anyone else who has now lived in Canada and appreciated what we have. We're all part of that group. What I'm very much disappointed in hearing is when people say, well, you're equal now, it's okay. And yet when we raise the issue of redress, suddenly, you know what, the Chinese Canadians who are part of the community, they're no longer taxpayers and their views don't count. In the same way that you or I, if we pay taxes or fail to pay taxes, our states will still be accountable for our taxes. I think this whole issue of, well, it's the previous government and administration, again, is irrelevant to the real issue here.
Where are the majority of these people? In which communities are they located? Either of you.
Go ahead, Nate.
We have, what year was it when the CCNC registered 4,000 head tax claimants from across the country? But there were 400 people who registered in Montreal, and I believe there was over 1,000 in Vancouver. Kenda, can you...
And others are scattered, are they?
Well, Peter, since 1984, when they began the campaign, Vancouver, I believe, had registered 1,500 with the group there. And in Toronto, their numbers across Canada as a total were probably about 2,500 outside of Vancouver. So you're looking at roughly about 4,000. You know, so I venture to guess that if you even go beyond the survivors who may only be in the hundreds, because they say their average now would be anywhere from the late 80s to the 90s in terms of actual age, if you took the rest, let's say the first sons, the descendants such as Danny Park who wrote into you, of that original, you know, 4,500, 5,000, there might only even be a half. So if we're lucky, we were talking maybe about 2,500 or 3,000 people. So, you know, the numbers have fallen drastically, and of course this is part of the Ottawa agenda.
Okay, hang on, the two of you got to take a fast break, and we'll get the listeners involved toll-free. What do you say? The lines are wide open at 1-877-399-9898. Call me now, toll-free, 1-877-399-9898. Call me right now. I'd like calls from across the country to gauge whether there is general public support for what these two people are trying to accomplish. This is Warren on the Weekend of the Chorus Radio Network. Okay, we're back with our two guests in Montreal. Mei Xu, who is counsel for the Chinese-Canadian Head Tax and Exclusion Act Redress Committee, and in Edmonton, Kenda G., who is chair of the Chinese-Canadian Head Tax and Exclusion Act Redress Committee. And we're loaded with calls. Well, let's see which way they're going to come. Out of Edmonton, Steve.
Hello.
Yes.
I really wonder at what point we draw the line and say that everyone has been wronged at some point. Does everyone have to be compensated as a result? I struggle with the precedents that are being set, and it's just going to be a case of at some point everyone is going to say, oh, I've been wronged, I need to be redressed. Where does it stop? That's my concern.
Kenda, all mate.
But Steve, I think it's a good question. I'm sorry, man, it's just I realized Steve's from Edmonton. I'd love to answer the question as a fellow Edmontonian. Steve, it's a good question because, you know, to be honest, when we all got involved in the campaign, these are questions that we ask as Canadians, and never mind that we're Chinese-Canadian. In the case of the Chinese community, as I mentioned to Peter earlier, we're talking about an event that is not ancient history. People tend to think that it's very old because the sad part of our history is that although Canada's Chinese have been here almost two centuries, the first reported arrival of Chinese was back in 1788. But you see, the last order and councils that applied to Chinese specifically, even when it came to racist immigration laws, were not removed from the books until 1969. In fact, some of the legislation which said Chinese males could not hire white women. The white women labor laws, they remained on the books in some form until the 1960s as well. So I agree with you. I think this is the sort of philosophy that Ottawa has brought upon the negotiations, is that we'll suddenly open the floodgates. But, you know, in all the dealings that I've been familiar with, what the Chinese community has asked for has been a drop in the bucket of what potentially they should be asking for. If you were to say, you know, we're looking at a $1.2 billion value in today's term, the reality is that in the negotiations, if the face value turns out to be $24 million, it's definitely not an issue of money or floodgates. It's just a question of whether Ottawa has the political willpower to do what is the right thing.
May, did you want to add something?
I wanted to ask a flipped question, which is your caller raised the question of precedent. So my question would be, well, if the government does not have to be held accountable for the harms that it commits, what would prevent the government from harming other groups in the future or other individuals? We're going to give a carte blanche to the government. Do whatever you want. You don't need to compensate.
Well, indeed, Peter, if we recall recently, May brings that point up.
Yeah.
We had the right of landing fee not that long ago. People were appalled, and eventually, you know what? Canada was forced to change the law, not because of what Ottawa was doing, but because of international pressure. They essentially said that a right of landing fee of $975 should be imposed on refugees and immigrants. And the United Nations said, rightfully so, how can you base the merits of a refugee's claim on his or her ability to pay $975? In Ottawa, the Convention of the Liberal Party, in fact, turned down the resolution, and yet it was an initiative that the government brought forward. The question that we would have as Chinese Canadians, or even Canadians in general, is, have we learned the lessons of the past? In the same way, as an example, to give you a modern version of this, is if you have a caregiver program and you're exploiting nannies who are predominantly from the Philippines, is there a point there where we have to re-examine our policy and say, wait a minute, we have a precedent, a good precedent in the sense that we've redressed the community, and it's an avenue we don't want to go further.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you have callers like Steve who seems open-minded enough, but look at the other half of the equation. Are we doing more harm or less harm by not redressing the community?
Hang on the line, please. This is Warren on the Weekend, the Chorus Radio Network.
Warren continues on CKNW News Talk 980.
Back with our two guests linking Edmonton and Montreal with members of the Chinese Canadian Head Tax and Exclusion Act Redress Committee. Emails coming in. Respond quickly so we can get as many calls in, if you would. Basically, a couple of emails saying, how can we ever make it up to everyone in the world? Which is really what Steve was saying from Edmonton, was it not?
Good. I mean, Peter, you know yourself, and I'm not sure what your position on this is, but what the Chinese have negotiated, it is not the entire world. In fact, relatively speaking, when you look at the claims compared to, let's say, what has already been offered, whether it's the merchant mariners or the World War II vets, Ottawa came forward and said, well, we're making an exception, and we're going to actually award compensation, but we're doing it as an exception because they're getting old. Well, I think most Canadians, if they're familiar with history, they know that many Chinese Canadians fought during the World Wars, and they did that while being disenfranchised at the same time. So in other words, they at one time had the right to vote.
Yeah.
It was taken away from them. And my question to Ottawa would be, do Chinese seniors not get old?
All right, Ryan in Calgary.
Yeah, I guess I'd just like to hear your guests answer the question that Steve from Edmonton asked, because I don't think they really provided an answer, and that is, why is it that Canadians, or a certain segment of Canadians, feel that the government or taxpayers are responsible to redress all of the bad that goes on in our history?
Well, you know, is that actually what's happening? As May had asked, what are the precedents that we've seen? They are relatively small. When you look at the expanse of our history, to have four or five major claims in the last decade come forward, with the obvious exception of First Nations, who rightfully should be redressed. In fact, I think most Canadians would agree with that.
I don't know about that.
I asked the same question that I asked Peter, which is that if we have governments, regardless of what administration it is, and we have laws that provide that you pay them taxes, do you think that when you've passed away that your estate is no longer going to be responsible? So this is a legal issue which May would speak to more in depth. It has to do with the concept of unjust enrichment. Should, as an example, laborers who worked for auto industries during the Second World War continue to benefit in profits because of policies that were considered unjust, in the same way that we're benefiting from policies that were clearly racist.
Actually, I wouldn't necessarily be against that principle, because by that logic, then we should wipe out the entire third world debt. Every time a country changes government, well, the new government's not responsible for the debts of the former.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think that really answers the question, because if you take a look at where you're going with this, if you were to set that precedent, you could bankrupt the country overnight, because every single person who's been wronged by a government decision, and that's a lot of people, would be up for financial redress from the government. Just think of every person who's been wronged because the government has a justice system that allows people who are convicted criminals back onto the street who again hurt people. That's just one item.
I'm sorry.
What about all the people who suffered under the War Measures Act during the October crisis? And I think what you're doing is you're taking hostage the ability for government to make decisions that are hard to make. I don't think people who made the decision to put a head tax on Chinese Canadians liked to make that decision, but at that time they thought that was the best decision. And if we're going to use hindsight to hold hostage every time a government official has to make a decision, or a group of men and women in those parliaments and the House of Commons have to make a decision, if they know that that's going to be second-guessed for the next 80 years, they're probably not going to want to make those decisions.
Okay.
And then how are we going to do anything?
Peter, may I ask the caller's name again? I'm sorry, I didn't hear what he
called.
My
name is Brian.
Oh, Brian. Brian, my question as far as the accountability again is that this is precisely the reason, though. Look at this the other way that we've talked earlier. If you have policies that are clearly bad policies even today, what accountability is there for you as a voter, or myself as a Canadian as well, to look in general terms and say,
to
in
change
the future,
the
what is going to stop Canada from introducing those laws, because they already have? So that, yes, we did have a right of landing fee, and yes, it was eventually rescinded, at least for refugees,
yep.
But you know it took international pressure in order to do that. Now,
that's
specifically
right.
With the Chinese head tax policy, this is what's fascinating about the entire history. When the Chinese were actively recruited by the Conservative government under John A. Macdonald, they were promised passage back, and they reneged on that deal. So the CPR and the Canadian government washed their hands of the affair.
See, let me tell you, that's not the first time that the Canadian government has reneged on the deal.
True enough. But what my point is that we would not have become a nation because they needed to link B.C. rather than see it as a gateway from Washington to Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as part of the policymaking during that period, the head tax served as a means of a compromise for the very racist government in British Columbia. But at the same time, when successive governments under the Liberals saw this as a windfall, the taxes were progressively increased purely for the fact or matter of increasing their revenues, because this money was never actually taxed that benefit the Chinese. It went into a general consolidated revenue fund.
Okay, but you know what? I can save you a lot of time, because I really do believe that what happened was wrong. I have no argument with you there. What happened was wrong, and what happened to a lot of people was wrong. There were many German Canadians who, at the same time that they were forced to put in internment camps, or they were held to their jobs and they couldn't move, or at the same time given a draft notice, and I'm related to some of those. And that wasn't right either, to tell them that they're not a Canadian, but they have to give their life for Canada. So the fact that bad things happen to Chinese Canadians is not lost on me.
But
what
Brian,
why is it that we as taxpayers have to take it out of our pocket every time someone feels that they have been wronged?
But Brian, as a Canadian, from what you've just said,
mm-hmm.
I would be full support of dealing with the German community or whichever community came.
But you know what? I wouldn't. Because you know what? I've got it's passed. We've got on. There's many good things that have come out of that, and I think it's fair.
But Brian, this is my question to you. What is it that concerns you, or what is the issue here?
The precedent you're going to set.
I'm sorry?
The precedent that you're going to set.
But what is the precedent? Are we talking about the actual finances behind it?
The finances and this idea that the Canadian government is a vehicle for...
Okay, let me explain
making people feel better.
Let me explain with the finances specifically. When the Chinese Canadian community was told by Ottawa that there was a recession and there were no funds available, they had a compromise solution of saying, let's take the face value of $24 million, because that was the face value. It's now worth $1.2 billion. But for the sake of the old-timers that were getting up in age, they said $24 million. At that time in 1983, the budget of one of the smallest portfolios we had, which is multiculturalism, was approximately $19 to $20 million. In essence, they could have paid off the redress and money would not have been an issue. But, you know, I've spent about 7 to 8 years of my life looking at this from a historical and legal perspective, and, you know, I've never found a very good argument as to why we shouldn't redress, and that includes a cost-benefit analysis which is devoid of any ethical question or any moral reasoning, purely on an economic basis. So as a taxpayer, if that's what's preventing people from mentally thinking of this, they should seriously reconsider the options that are available. Because you know what? Redress is not going to go away, whether it's this issue or other communities that have been affected.
So are you saying your argument for this is that because the financial amount is so small?
Well, my argument is that nobody has really come forward to, well, when you say precedent, is it that because it takes too much effort to say I'm sorry or that the monies are going to be suddenly depleted? I've heard
no,
this
because
argument
I'm saying
before
that humans
that we're
run
going
the
to go bankrupt.
Humans
you
are
know
going to make mistakes.
Since these
Let's
arguments
get over
have been
that,
brought
right?
up, I have yet to see any government go bankrupt because of redress.
All
the
right,
fact of the matter is the government in Canada still holds the power.
Kenda, I want to get other people in here. Brian, thank you for your call. Iris in Surrey.
Hi. I really agree with that guy that was saying about us redressing. My forefathers have been here, I believe it's almost 200 years. There were no Chinese here at this time. But if they're so anxious to get this money that they say is owing to them, then they might as well pay us the money that we paid to keep those three shiploads of Chinese that came here, and we had, the taxpayers had to pay to keep them going, keep them in everything that they needed. I mean, where are we going to stop?
All right. Bruno.
Hey, how you doing?
Let's get on with it.
Hey, Peter, I haven't talked to you for a long time. You know what gets me? Okay, so far everybody said the magic word, Canadian. And that means a mixture of a bunch of races in a pool of water, basically, okay? Now, you want to come to this country? Then you do what the country says. If not, you don't. I'm an immigrant myself. My parents are. And for the longest time, back in, well, when Italy joined Hitler, I got relatives that died in concentration camps in Canada. Do I have the right to get money from the government? I don't think so.
Well,
I'm just proud enough to be
actually,
a Canadian.
Actually, the Japanese government has offered compensation, so the short answer to the question is, yes, there are precedents internationally.
No, the thing is that everybody that comes to Canada figures after, I don't know, 20, 30 years, because of some reason or another, they were interned, or they were studied, or whatever, that Canada owes them the rest of their life to live.
All right, Bruno, you're making your point. Vivian is the last call for our two guests. Go ahead.
Is that mine?
Yes.
First of all, we wanted the Chinese to come to build the railway, and then when the railway was finished, what to do with them? If you tour the tunnels in Moose Jaw, and I don't mean the infamous running tunnels, but the Chinese tunnels, nobody wanted to see them on the street, but they came to Moose Jaw because that was a terminal point for the railway. And they were put in dreadful conditions underground, and they had to live under there, and bosses that took advantage of them took their money for an awful bunk, and which was right beside the laundry machines, and they lived under dreadful conditions, but they had so little left that they couldn't send any money home. They couldn't earn enough money to go back home. It took them such a long time, and yet the Ukrainians that came to Saskatchewan were never charged a head tax or treated like that.
You're in favor of redress, are you?
Well, Japanese got it, so why not Chinese?
All right. So where do we go from here, Kenda Romay?
Well, I really apologize, Peter. I'd like, you know, May to answer a lot more questions. I'm sorry that our time is so limited, but just briefly, I wanted to say that there is going to be a screening of Karen Cho's NFB film, In the Shadow of Gold Mountain, again on January 11th at News World CBC. It starts at 7 p.m. Pacific, 8 Mountain. I believe it'll be 10 o'clock Eastern. But as you may or may not know, May was the author responsible for the UN submission this past year,
right,
which resulted in a recommendation from the UN that Ottawa compensate Canada as Chinese. And New Zealand, as I mentioned, has already negotiated with the Chinese as well in their country. So I hope to remain silent for the remainder of this this interview and let May tell you a bit more detail.
Okay, May, you've got a couple of minutes.
Okay, well, basically I would like to tell your callers and your audience that as a Chinese Canadian who wants to be on equal footing with all the other Canadians, I will continue to fight for the principles that makes Canada the country that it is today, which is a Canada founded on law and a Canada that is founded by justice and human rights. And if you don't mind, I would just like to read that paragraph, which is the recommendation of the Special Rapporteur, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. And I'd like to remind people that Canada signed the International Convention Against All Forms of Racism and Racial Discrimination. So what the Special Rapporteur recommended to the Canadian government last March 1st, 2004, is that he wrote, now that the Canadian government has recognized the situation of Japanese Canadians as a special case, which has led to the grant of financial compensation, it should, in the same spirit, restart consultations with members of the Chinese community in Canada in order to consider the possibility of compensating the descendants of persons who pay the head tax or members of their families who are affected by that measure. And until we get compensation, in my eyes, Canada will not be a country founded on justice and human rights.
Okay, got to leave it there. Kendra and May, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Peter, for having us.
Righty. And apologies to people we left on the line. We're coming back with your Saturday Weekender. This is Warren.